Welcome to Street Hypnosis. This is session one of the masterclass entitled How to Really Use NLP for Amazing Results. This masterclass is really all about NLP and its relationship to hypnosis. Of course, we're all hypnotists here. And as a result, I'm going to presume a certain amount of base knowledge. The base knowledge, of course, is in the Secrets of Hypnosis Revealed course. And I want you to understand certain things like the ABS formula and what hypnosis is, the conscious mind, the unconscious mind, these kind of concepts. And assuming that you know those, I'm going to launch into the NLP elements without any embellishments on that sort of things, so that we can get through the content of NLP and how it applies to hypnosis much more quickly and much more elegantly. So first of all, let's start with the core idea. What is NLP? Well, NLP stands for Neuro-Linguistic Programming. There are many different definitions. One I like is the study of how language and perception affects our nervous system and makes changes. So you can reprogram, if you like, the nervous system through the use of language to change the way people perceive the world. The original founders were a man called John Grinder and Richard Bandler, and back in the 1970s, they came up with a quirky and rather interesting project in which they decided to do something called modeling, where they would go and check out some successful therapist and then find out what it is that they're doing. Now, the approach they used was particularly interesting because they turned particularly into language. What kind of things were they saying in order to help their clients change? Now, of course, language is just one way that you can slice up the pie, and this is the way that NLP tends to focus on. The first two therapists that they focused with were Virginia Satir and Fritz Perls. One was for family therapy, the other one for gestalt therapy. And after studying them and their transcripts for a while, they came up with what is known as the meta model. The meta model is basically a series of questions that gets more and more specific so that as people get into these questions and sort of answer the information being asked for, they tend to recover choices and they tend to recover, or rather, they tend to uncover the root of their problem and as a result be released from it. So that's kind of the rough background to where NLP came from. But then something very interesting happened. Somewhere in the mid-70s, when they were presenting this miraculous new paper to a man called Gregory Bateson, who was very thrilled, by the way, by this discovery, he told them that they missed a bit of the pie, because whilst these questions had the unique characteristic of like drilling down into content and getting very specific and precise so people could realize when they're just inventing problems, he told them that they failed to recognize the contribution of another man called Milton Erickson, a hypnotist who did some amazing things with language. In fact, he basically broke all of John Grinder's and Richard Bandler's rules for therapy and got amazing changes anyway. That is the point at which NLP was really born. When Richard Bandler and John Grinder went off to study Milton Erickson, study his ways, and to dissect his hypnotic language, they created NLP as a result of it. This is what has led, I think, Richard Bandler to saying that NLP is basically an attitude and a methodology that leaves behind a trail of techniques. Now, that doesn't really mean very much to most people, because what is he saying? It's a way of thinking and doing stuff so that you get other stuff out of it. Not very informative. What most people consider NLP to be is basically a bunch of techniques, therapeutic techniques that help people make changes, run their brain, etc. In reality, according to Grinder and Bandler, of course, NLP is the study of excellence. It's the study of how people become more than average, better than average. So in some respects, NLP is the study of accelerated learning. However, this is not what most people would consider NLP to be in the lay terms. They will think of the terms of communication skills, the language skills, and above all else, these snazzy techniques that create these great amounts of change. Now, because most of these techniques, most of these approaches and ideas were modeled from Milton Erickson, one of the foremost hypnotists of the time, you can really say that NLP is a hypnotic discipline. In fact, I'd go so far as to saying that NLP is actually a covert form of direct hypnosis. In other words, a disguised form of hypnosis. And the reason I say this is because, especially when we come in a later session to the actual NLP techniques themselves, they don't tend to work unless you're actually fulfilling all the criteria you would need to fulfill in order to induce a hypnotic trance. In other words, the ABS formula still applies. A, you need to absorb people's attention. B, you need to bypass the critical filters. S, you need to stimulate your unconscious mind. And all the NLP techniques do is those three things. When they fail, they haven't done one of those three things. And when they succeed, they've done all of those three things in the right way. So my preference is to look at NLP as a subset of hypnosis. It's a very elegant set of tools. It's a very elegant way of thinking and seeing the world. And it isn't a crazy new innovation. It's just a very interesting perspective on the field we know as hypnosis. In fact, there's an interesting story of a famous NLP trainer who, during one of his sessions with, I think, Richard Bandler at the time, turned around during one of the breaks and asked him, "So Richard, tell me, isn't what we're just doing here stuff to keep the conscious mind busy, in other words, bypass the critical factor, whilst we kind of feed suggestions to your unconscious mind?" And Richard apparently got very upset about it and stormed off, came back a few minutes later and asked him to denominalize suggestion. And denominalizing basically means take the word suggestion and rather than turning into a thing, turn into a process. How do you suggest something to someone else and have it be effective? That is the study of NLP. So in many ways, it has a lot of common ground with hypnosis. Now, one of the basic models in NLP is something called the universal modeling process. It's the NLP model of the mind, if you like. Of course, as hypnotists, we are familiar with working with the conscious mind and the unconscious mind, and that's a very useful model to work with. I'd like to introduce you to some ideas which are specific to NLP, which grew around actually from the 70s and from linguistics and how linguistics at that time perceived that people were influenced by language. Although many of these ideas have changed over time, I think it's still a very useful filter, very useful model to borrow to view other people from. It's a very simplified view of the world that allows you to understand what happens inside the mind in a very minimalist sort of way. The first thing to look at is something called the bird whistle study. Now, the bird whistle study was by Dr. Ray L. Birdwhistle back in the 1970s. And he basically did a study, he repeated a study by another man called Mehrabian, who basically discovered that when people interact with each other, particularly when they have ambiguous messages, then the meaning of the communication isn't all carried by the words. In fact, only about 7% of the importance of the significance of an interaction is actually carried by the words. 38% is carried by the tonality, and about 55% by other nonverbal cues. Now, this is very important when we go into neurolinguistic programming, NLP. Why? Because when we talk about language and use of language, etc., those are the words that we're using. But all that has to nestle in everything else. So the tonality and your nonverbal behavior all feed into what you're doing also. So whilst we may be specifically focusing on language as a device, remember that all the things around it will also be important and will be part of the way that you communicate your message and you offer your suggestions in the NLP model. The universal modeling process that NLP likes to work off is in your manual. And very basically, if you imagine a human being, the human being has five senses and information comes in through those five senses. That has to be digested somehow, has to be sorted out from being random electrical stimuli into being something meaningful. And then that person has to respond to those meaningful stimuli. Now, the universal modeling process gives you a very simple way of looking at this. Let's imagine that you see something. Then that information is broken down through a series of filters. Those filter things like your beliefs, your attitudes, your mood, your personal history, your memories, your conception of space-time, matter and energy, your meta-programs. There's a whole bunch of these filters through which that information gets filtered. And then as they go through that, those filters, something happens to that information that makes it more useful or functional to us as human beings. Essentially, that information either gets deleted, distorted, or generalized. What do I mean by this? Well, if information comes in that doesn't fit one of those filters, it just gets rejected. It's deleted. We're no longer aware of it and has no impact on us. If it's distorted, That means information comes through and it kind of squeezes through one of these filters and comes out the other end a little bit different. Usually, for example, if you have a belief about something that people will treat you unfairly, let's say, then when people do something nice for you, then that will get distorted in a way that will prove to you that they just want to have something from you, they're just doing it to get their own, to have an advantage over you or something like that. So it just goes to prove the belief rather than to disprove it. That's an example of information that's been distorted through the belief system or a filter, which is called a belief. Finally, we have the idea of generalization. Generalization is the basis of all learning because it gives you the ability to go to some house you've never seen before, walk up to the door, and instantly recognize the door is a door and how to use it. It allows you to recognize that that people are people and trees are trees. It allows you to learn and extend that information to things you've never come across so that you can use those with equal ease. It's been said that deletion is the basis of sanity. In other words, it keeps you sane because it gets rid of information so you don't hit overload. Distortion is the basis of creativity. It's the ability to look at something from such a unique perspective that something entirely new can be born out of it. And generalization, as we've already mentioned, is the basis of learning, acquiring new information. So with those three mechanisms and those filters inside the mind, the information gets changed, so deleted, distorted, or generalized, and then it somehow hits this amorphous mass we'll call for a moment the mind. Inside the mind, it creates, according to NLP, an internal representation. Now, an internal representation is basically like a holographic projection of the outside world. It's kind of trying to recreate the world outside of you, but inside your mind, so that you can understand that world. So an internal representation will be made up of feelings, of sounds, of things you can see, smell, taste, etc. That internal representation is then the mechanism that tells your body and the rest of your mind of how to respond to it. In other words, the information comes in, it gets filtered, it creates an internal representation, if you like, a map of the outside world. According to whatever is in that map, you will then respond to the outside world by changing your state, in other words, your mood will shift, you'll change a behavior, in other words, you'll behave differently towards someone. For example, if you perceive the animal in front of you as a dangerous creature, you may well run or fight. If you perceive the same animal in front of you as being a docile farm animal, you may want go over there and pat it. Two different behaviors, and also two different states, based entirely on what map the information has left inside your mind. In other words, the internal representation. The third thing that the internal representation affects is your physiology. In other words, it's kind of a behavior, but it's on a very tiny level. It's your skin coloration, your muscle tone, the little jerk of an eyebrow, your pupil dilation. So these are all little unconscious behaviors that signal to the outside world or subcommunicate to the outside world what's going on inside the person. And the idea is that these little subcommunications, these physiological changes, can be tracked back to what's going on inside someone's mind. And if you get good at reading these signals, you get so good that you can literally read someone's mind after a period of time. These signals are called in NLP BMIRs, behavioral manifestation of an internal representation. It basically means that you have a map, picture of, or a movie inside your mind. It changes the way you think and feel, and as a result, changes those little micromuscular movements, your blood flow, etc. When people see that, after a period of time of calibrating, of getting used to, they can tell with very high levels of accuracy what's going on inside your mind just based on your physiological shifts, your changes. So that's kind of the basic background to what makes NLP NLP. That's the history, as well the, if you like, the conceptual framework, the model that they use in order to be able to develop all the ideas, the actual techniques, etc. that's in NLP. Does all this kind of make sense to you so far?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Okay. Any questions?
Not so far, no.
So much for the foundational concepts. Now let's turn our attention to a very important part of that whole process we described, which are the filters. Remember, a key piece is the information comes in through the senses and then is filtered before it creates its internal map. Now, in order to understand how to change people's maps and therefore change the way they feel and think and behave, we need to really understand what are these filters and how can we influence those filters then by our own language and our own behavior. Now, there are many different types of filters, and the ones that I want to begin with are the basics on which we're going to found the rest of this masterclass. One of the filters that the NLP likes to use a lot is called the presuppositions of NLP. These are, if you like, ideas, concepts that people within the realms of NLP adopt and pretend to be true. They'll adopt as if they were totally true, because by doing so, it alters your own perceptions, in other words, the way you see the world, in such a way that you are more capable of influencing the world around you. Now, I'd like to introduce you to these useful frames, these NLP presuppositions, initially just as an idea, and then we'll have a little chat about each one of them. Going through them in order, the first one is the idea that the map is not the territory. The second one is the idea that the meaning of your communication is the response that you get. The third one is that individuals have all the resources that they need in order to achieve their desired outcomes. The next one is that there is no such thing as failure. All that there is feedback. Then we have every behavior is motivated by a positive intention, which means that people make the best choices they can with the resources they have available. The intention is always positive. Next, we have effective communication, or rather effective communicators, will accept and utilize everything. So there's no such thing as resistance to what you're saying. It's just a sign that you haven't communicated something properly. Then we have the element in the system that has the greatest flexibility will be the catalyst for that system. In other words, will control that system. Finally, we look at the idea of respect. Seeing that everyone has their own unique model of the world, we should all respect each other's models of the world. In other words, there's no right and wrong model, and there's no, if you like, forcing your view of the world onto someone else. Let's just look at these presuppositions in a little bit more detail so that we can understand what we mean by them in terms of NLP. The map is not the territory. It comes from Alfred Korzybski from the 1950s in a book called Science and Sanity. Basically turns around and says to people that when we look at the world, the thing that we think we see, in other words, what we think the real world is, doesn't exist. It's just a hallucination we make up inside our mind as a result of these filters that we just talked about. So to think that our perception of the world is actually the real world is like going to a restaurant and trying to eat the menu. The menu only represents the meal you're going to have. It's not the real thing. This becomes very important when people get too kind of caught up in the labeling process behind NLP, or a bit behind language. And one of the ways that we understand the world is by giving labels. This is a chair, this is a table, this is such and such a person, this is such and such an institution. And by labeling it, we get to kind of understand its parameters, what it can be used for and what it can't be used for. Chairs are for sitting in, not for standing on, not for painting with. It limits the use of that device, but at the same time, it helps us to master the device by having a convenient little pigeonhole to put it into. And what NLP reminds us, or the map is not the territory reminds us, is that our perception of reality is not necessarily the real thing. So whenever we have a problem in the world, very often it could just be that our maps are faulty. In other words, if we see an animal and are scared by it, it's just our map that is faulty. If we change the map, we realize that the dog that's frightening us is just a cuddly little chihuahua and totally friendly. By changing the map, we change our response and therefore we regain control over our lives. The next one, the meaning of your communication is the response you get. This is a beautiful one because it puts responsibility on the communicator in being eloquent. If you say something and someone else gets upset or angry or refuses to do what you ask them, you can look at it one of two ways. you can absolve yourself of responsibility and say, well, I was reasonable in what I said, and that's it. That's the final story. But that's not very useful because it doesn't get anyone any further. The other person's still upset and you still haven't got the task done. If instead you look at it from the point of view that you have the power and maybe even part of the responsibility to change a misunderstanding, to change the way that you talk to someone and communicate with someone, so rather than getting angry and upset, for example, they end up becoming influenced by you. They end up thinking it's a good idea or doing what you ask for them to do. At that point, you recover choice. Rather than just saying something and letting the world deal with it as best they can, you now get to structure your communication in such a way that it elegantly influences people around you. So the meaning of your communication is the response you get. If you say something, it doesn't matter what your intention was when saying it. What matters is how the other person perceived it. And if your intention is to give a compliment, but it's perceived as an insult, then all you need to do is change the way you're saying it so that the other person can perceive it as a compliment rather than an insult. Do those two presuppositions make sense so far?
Yeah, they do.
Okay. Next we come on to, individuals have all the resources they need to achieve their desired outcomes. Now this is an important one, and particularly when we're talking about doing change work, but also in other fields of work, teaching, in management, in sales, every kind of situation. The person in front of you has at some level in their mind the ability to achieve what it is that they want to achieve. Now, how can you say this is possible? For example, let's say someone wants to become a world-class writer, but it can't even read and write. How can you say that they have it inside them to write? Well, they may not know how to write yet, but they have the ability to learn. So it's a question of finding the right levels of motivation in order to either acquire new skills and new information, or question of using things that you already know about but maybe have forgotten about or have somehow become blocked off from in order to be able to achieve the outcomes you want. You see this all the time. For example, the person that is highly successful in business but terribly unlucky in love. If only they could use the same kind of decision-making clarity in the way that they choose business partners and clients, in the way that they choose a life partner, well, perhaps that person will have a better time of it in their personal relationships. It's a question of either accessing skills that they already have, or at the very least, accessing their willingness and the ability to learn in order to get the skills that they need in order to be able to learn and grow as a human being. Next we have, there is no failure, only feedback. This is kind of related to what we just talked about. A lot of people, especially in the Western world, fear failure. Why? Because in school we get punished. We got punished for over a decade for getting things wrong. Little red marks, you're not good enough, people pointing, maybe laughing at you, maybe being singled out as a glass dunce or something like that. So for most of our lives, when we're being shaped from being children to becoming adults, we have had instilled in us that other people will be the judge of our value. And as a result, a lot of people develop this idea that they have to get it right the first time because getting it wrong is too painful, it's too frightening for them. There is no failure, only feedback reverses that idea around. It basically says that it doesn't matter how many times you fail. If at each time that you fail, you just learn from the experience, then the next time you'll get close to your task and eventually you'll figure out how to do it. The old classic motivational story is about Thomas Edison, who took 1,000 tries to find the right combinations of gases and substances that would allow him to invent the light bulb. And people asked him, you know, why are you still going? And when he was asked once he'd actually succeeded, how did he keep going after all those failures? He turned around and said, well, I didn't fail 999 times. I just found 999 combinations that did not work. So rather than treating something as a failure, treat it as information that feeds forward into the next time you do it until eventually you crack the right combination for the lock and get the result that you want. All that fear, self-doubt, recrimination, all those sort of things will do is prevent you from going forwards. And the only way you can really fail at something is if you give yourself a time limit in which to succeed. In other words, you say, this is the last time I'll do this. If I don't do it now, I'm a failure. That's the only time you can fail. For the rest of it, you have to just keep going on and on and on until eventually it works out. You only have to remember, you only have to succeed once to be a success. And all the failures that came before it, at that point, will be forgotten. So do those presuppositions make sense so far?
Yeah, a lot of sense.
Let's move on to now quite a contentious one. And in this one, you may want to come online and argue with me a little bit on this one. And it's that every behavior is motivated by a positive intention. People make the best choices they can with the resources they have available. Now, this is basically saying that you don't look at what people are doing, the behavior. You look at the intention that drives those behavior. And when you look at the intention at a high enough level, the intention will always be positive, even if the behavior is really messed up. So we're talking about really messed up behavior like murder, theft, like abuse, like anything you can possibly imagine. These are vile behaviors, totally reprehensible. And yet, something that causes them to begin is very positive inside that person. And if you can just reach that positive element, you have the right leverage in order to change the behavior to something more positive as well, something more beneficial to the person and the world around themselves. Now, at this point, I'm hoping that a lot of alarm bells are ringing inside you, that you have all kinds of counterexamples as to why this might not be the case. Anything like that come to mind at the moment?
Well, I can understand why, how every behavior fulfills a purpose, but the fact that it's a positive purpose is making...
That's right.
It's kind of hard to grasp at the moment, yeah.
And it is, isn't it? Can you think of an example where you just can't see a positive purpose or a positive intention for the behavior at all?
Let's say like a child abuser or something.
Okay, so why would a child abuser abuse a child?
For some sort of gratification or...
Okay. So let's take the idea of gratification. Why would that person need gratification or want gratification?
Well, I suppose it's a just sort of inherent human trait. This has been misplaced somewhere along the line.
Like what kind of human trait might that be?
I suppose in that case some sort of power or something like this. The need to be in control.
Okay, so it might be that the person wants to feel in control, and the way that he exercises that desire or tries to gratify it is by abusing someone small that he can physically dominate, right?
Sure.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that the desire to feel in control is a bad thing?
No.
Right.
Not necessarily.
There's a positive intention. It doesn't necessarily mean that abusing a child is the right way of going about it, but the desire to feel in control in your life is absolutely a positive intention, as would be the desire for love, as would be the desire for affection, or a bunch of other desires. The fact that it's just being twisted in terms of how it comes out in terms of behavior is another story entirely. Now, when you understand this, you get a lot more leverage over people, because rather than condemning the behavior and then they're stuck, because the more you try and change the behavior, which is linked to an intention, the more they'll hold on to it. But when you actually go straight to the intention and you start finding other behaviors that satisfy the intention at least as well as, if not better than the original one, let's face it, people aren't stupid. If they can actually have something, a behavior, that makes, for example, with child abuse, if the person has a series of behaviors available to them, which makes them feel much more powerful and much more in control than any kind of child abuse could ever do, do you think they'd carry on child abusing, or would they spend their time in these new behaviors instead?
In the new behaviors.
That's right, because it creates precedence. It satisfies the need, the intention, more completely. And this is the beauty of every behavior's model motivated by a positive intention. It allows you to look behind people's activities, and rather than getting stuck on external behaviors, you can go behind them and change behaviors at the level of intention. And you actually get to have a lot of leverage as well. We'll show you some NLP techniques that work off this later on in the course. But this is the beauty of this. Now, thinking of it in these terms, can you think of any other situation that you could not explain in terms of this particular presupposition?
No, I think that was quite an extreme example I gave you, so if it fits that. So what it is then basically is looking at the intent of the behavior rather than the behavior itself.
Exactly. You separate intention from behavior. It's one of the key principles in a lot of NLP techniques, actually a lot of hypnosis techniques. It's true for hypnosis, for sales, for management, for teaching, for any kind of human interaction. What you see when you get a behavior from someone is not the whole story. There's something that drives that behavior. And if you understand that driver, then you understand the person. So rather than fighting at the level of behavior, which is a very difficult thing to fight, you fight at the level of intention, which is much easier to fight given that the intention is ultimately always a positive one.
Sure, okay.
So let's move on to the next one. Effective communication is utilization. So if you're an effective communicator, you'll utilize everything. Another way of putting this is to say that resistance is a sign of insufficient pacing. Basically, what that says is that, remember, inside someone's mind, someone's got their own intentions and their own view of the world, etc. And when people resist you, they're basically putting their shields up because somehow you're threatening something inside their world. It could be an intention that's not being met. It could be that you're saying that some part of the world is so when they want it to be different, and that feels threatening to them. Now, basically what you've done there is you've just taken too big a step. So if you go back and take more baby steps, eventually you'll get to the same place. It's just you can lead the person by the hand towards clarity. Now, this is particularly interesting as a hypnotist, for example, when you think of ideas like seeding suggestions. If you make suggestions like you're bold and confident, it might be too big a suggestion to give to someone straight away, and their unconscious mind will reject it, going, no, I'm weak and everyone always abuses me or dominates me. So you may want to just create the suggestions piecemeal and say, you're not as weak as you think. That could be acceptable. Then you can turn from not as weak as you think to you have something positive about you. And bit by bit, you begin to build up the self-esteem until the bold, confident suggestions actually can take effect. And this is as true of any kind of situation as it is in a hypnotherapeutic situation. So I'm just using that as an example. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Let's turn to the next one, which is that the element in the system with the greatest flexibility will be the catalyst and end up controlling that system. So we're talking about systems theory here, which is basically to say, you talk about, this is as true internally when we talk about, if you like, different parts of people, as well as externally when a society, like a social group, is together. It could be a workplace, it could be a family, it could be any kind of unit, of social unit of behavior. Within that social unit, there's a system, and the person within that system that is the most flexible will end up controlling it. That is to say, the one which has the greatest range of behaviors that they can throw at the system will find the right leverage points to make them, the whole system, do what it wants. So we're talking about, you come across this, the children that throw tantrums and end up controlling the entire family. Sometimes as a pet. I've had this before where I've walked in people's houses and they dote on their pet so much, the dog runs the family. When the dog barks, then people feed it. It gets on the couch and pushes other people off. It always gets priority. So in that respect, the dog runs a system. Now, the idea of flexibility is great. In other words, the more flexible you are, the more likely it is you'll find the right hot button that switches the system around and gets it to do what you would like it to do or make it function in a better way. The interesting thing, though, is that I think a lot of people misunderstand this idea of flexibility. They basically think that if you can bend over backwards, then you are more flexible than other people. So if you let people walk all over you, you say, can you do this? And you go, oh, okay. Will you do that? Well, okay. Right? If you're a jack of all trades and keep saying yes to everything, that is a sign of flexibility. And it isn't. Because if you're incapable of saying no, and saying no so stubbornly that you will never change your position on that particular point, how can you be flexible? Because you've just deleted a kind of behavior out of your repertoire. So being flexible includes your ability to be inflexible. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
And of course, it doesn't necessarily mean that being inflexible is the only solution. It just means that you want to pay attention that sometimes being stubborn is the right answer, and sometimes giving way is the right answer, and sometimes something totally different is the right answer. Okay?
Okay. Igor, so I suppose this that applies to a therapist very, very highly then.
Immensely so. In fact, all of these things were originally designed primarily for therapists, and it was only later discovered that they tend to apply across the board of human relations. So as a therapist, you want to be the one who's more flexible, not your client. Sometimes you become more stubborn. Imagine this, and by the way, I have seen therapists do this with great success. Imagine you are more stubborn than your client is about the problem that they have. So that you're so stubborn that they don't need it anymore and they don't have it anymore, that they give up the problem because they're convinced by your stubbornness. They kind of give in to your stubbornness. That's kind of a interesting model for therapy, isn't it? Of course, the opposite is also true. Sometimes you work around their stubbornness, around their inflexibility, and you come at it from such a subtle angle that they never see the change coming until they can just let go into it and be happy with the changes that have come. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So the final of the NLP presuppositions is this: respect each person's model of the world. Basically, it's a bit of a relativistic point of view in the sense to say that none of our maps is any better than the other. So the map that you have inside your mind is no better than the map of the world that I have inside my mind. And so why should I impose my map on you? It would be disrespectful of me to say that my map's better, so start thinking the way I think or else. Now, I think to a great extent that's true. At the same time, when it says respect each person's model of the world, I think it also means respect your own. Because there's people, for example, out there who will denigrate their own view in favor of someone else's because they don't want to give offense. So there is, of course, a skill to be able to maintain respect for your own model of the world, whilst, of course, still having a respect for other people's models of the world. This is, for example, where I think religion is a great example of this. When you have signs of religious tolerance, especially amongst, religious leaders, when they can meet each other, and although they have very different viewpoints about which God is right and which procedures in terms of worshiping God is right, etc., they can still have a dialogue and respect the fact that there is a lot of humanity in the other religion. There's a lot of ethics, etc., and that's the common starting point. At that point, they're demonstrating an immense respect for each other's model of the world, even though they're not disrespecting their own. Now, this is important, particularly when you are in any kind of interaction with other people, because to the extent that you threaten someone else's model of the world, you will activate their defense mechanisms. Defense mechanisms are things like anger, like fear, like avoidance. They'll avoid you or the topic entirely. These are all mechanisms the mind uses in order to protect itself, to protect its worldview, beliefs, attitudes, etc. So unless you want to activate a defense mechanism, your best bet is be respectful of the other person's model of the world. And if you're going to introduce changes to it, do it so respectfully so that it evolves naturally and then can incorporate the change in a way that is beneficial to the sum of the person's total personality. In that way, you don't force a change on someone that might be actually disastrous for them. Here's an example. Let's say that you have a very stubborn person who almost out of principle does the opposite of what anyone tells them. On the surface of that, it may seem, negative that if you say black, they'll say white just by definition. But what if this person, let's say they're a teenager, what if they are in a family which is so dysfunctional, maybe even slightly schizophrenic, where doing everything that they're told is actually harmful for them? Where they need to be able to create a shield from the negative attitudes that are being projected onto them by their parents, for example. So at this point, taking away their protection will actually make them worse off than they would have been had they been left alone. So in order to be able to take away or to remove that shield, if you like, you first have to do other things so that they have other coping mechanisms, better shields, so that they don't have to say, black is white and white is black out of principle. They can, for example, have a discrimination mechanism, which is with these people, yes, with these people, no. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So these are the NLP presuppositions. They're very powerful and they're very important in terms of how you view change work, how you view interactions with other people, and what you do or how you use NLP. Because people think NLP are just techniques you throw at people, and if you use these filters, these presuppositions, as part of a general attitude whilst applying the NLP techniques, they tend to be much more successful because you're not going to run into as many problems with, for example, activating defense mechanisms, which will automatically reject your techniques. And the other person is much more likely to surrender into a hypnotic state where you can bypass the critical factor and actually adjust their mental map in a very respectful kind of way. So those are the presuppositions. A couple of other filters that are important to be aware of are, for example, perceptual positions. Perceptual positions basically goes from the following idea. You look at the world from your point of view, the next person looks at it from their point of view, and so does the rest of the world. So whenever you are in an interaction with another human being, there are at least three points of view you can take. That's your point of view, their point of view, and a neutral third party looking at it, like they're watching a film, and deciding without being biased towards one person or the other, what the situation, what is the right or wrong of the situation. There's also a fourth possible position, which is kind of like the sum total of all those experiences. But let's stick to the three for now. Now, the reason this is useful, again, you know the old saying, walking in someone else's footsteps for a mile, it gives you a very different view of what's going on. So if you have an argument with someone, and you just look at it from your point of view and saying that showed them, but then if you just take the moment to literally step inside their mind, see it from their point of view, with their feelings, with their attitudes, and get a sense, especially using ideas like positive intention and behavior, why would they be saying these? Why would they be doing these things? And suddenly you realize perhaps that that person felt hurt by something that you said. Perhaps you were coming across too stubborn. Perhaps you were coming across in a negative way. And they had to defend themselves. And maybe they did it too harshly, but they were defending themselves. Now you've acquired more information. You understand that situation more clearly. The same is true, again, if you take a neutral third-party position and you watch those two people over there arguing. And you realize that both of them are kind of right and both of them are kind of wrong. Again, that gives you much more distance, much more perspective, and much more ability to appreciate the totality of the situation without getting stuck in one point of view, which won't necessarily help resolve the problem. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. The next filter that is useful to understand is very simply chunking. By chunking is basically what level of information do you like to have? Some people like to have minute details. Other people like to have the big picture. Some people like to start with the big picture and then go into detail and vice versa. So everyone's a little bit different. For example, why is this important? Let's say you're talking to someone. Let's say this is a sales meeting. Let's say this person is a very big picture person. They're oriented towards large chunks of information. You go in and you start describing your product in minute detail. The benefits in minute detail. That person is going to get overloaded so quickly, they're going to have no sense of overview, they're going to not see the wood for the trees, and they probably end up not buying something that might be very useful for them, just because they're overloaded. They don't understand what it is you're offering to them, because there's too much information. Let's turn the opposite, though. Let's say that you have someone who's very details-oriented, and you just give them this really big picture overview. They look at that, and it means nothing to them. Like, if I say to you that NLP is an attitude and a methodology that leaves behind it a trail of techniques. Some people will understand it instantly and go, yeah, that makes sense. Other people will have absolutely no idea what that's supposed to mean. There's absolutely no function. It serves no purpose. Why? Because it's not attached to anything. In other words, no detail. If I then go into detail and say, well, an attitude, you know, your state of mind, how you look at things, you know, if you're creative or you're going to be curious, if you're going to do it this way or that way, at that point, you're beginning to chunk down into detail, and the other person that's going, oh, that makes sense, because I can understand the world seen from that level of detail. Now, the reason this is again important is because everyone has their own little filters inside their mind, and you want to basically discover what level of filter the person in front of you is working at so that you can present your information. In other words, when you talk to them, you can talk to them at the right level. If you give too much information, they won't get it. If you give too little information, they won't get it. You have to find just the right amount, and each person will be different according to what chunk size they like to have. Does that make sense?
Yep.
And again, this is a great understanding also in terms of how you sequence information. For example, when you're doing a training course, there'll be large chunks that you want to get through, there'll be small chunks, and then it'll be detailed chunks. When you write a report, again, you'll be able to break the information up into big chunks and the ever smaller chunks as you go along. So understanding what logically is an equivalent chunk size in information helps you to organize information, which helps you to understand it more, to organize it inside yourself, but it also helps you to organize it inside of other people. Okay?